This is an iHeart podcast.
Okay, so let's talk about China, shall we? That's what the entire special was going to be about, China. And this can be one of those things that normal people, people like you, you don't really know what to do about it. And it seems like such a big issue that it's beyond us, right? We're talking nation state stuff. But here's one of the things we all need to do. We have to acknowledge, first and foremost, there is a competition and we must win it. And maybe when it comes to, you know, United States versus China, maybe you're of the mind, because I hear this a lot, of I don't care, why do we even bother, why are we even... Well, listen, just like all warfare, whether it be kinetic or otherwise, only one vote matters. China has decided that we are in competition. China has made that decision. What you think about it doesn't mean anything at all. What I think about it doesn't mean anything at all. I cannot want that competition, but China has written down, we are competing with America and we intend to supplant them as the number one country on the planet. And we have to acknowledge what that means. We don't know what a world like that is like because we've never lived in it. But what I do know is you have the communist Chinese making decisions and we can't rebuff them. That means a completely different way of life for everyone who lives on Earth. If they become number one, it's a major, major problem. And so let's look at some of the things they've done here. I mean, look, let's just talk about COVID alone. I mean, the China special could be 18 hours long, but let's look at what they did during COVID. China realized very quickly they had a problem. They had some sort of a virus, some sort of a disease. China immediately moves to shut down domestic air travel. You're not allowed to just fly from Beijing to Shanghai. No, we're shutting down air travel. But China allowed, after they shut down domestic air travel, they allowed international travel. In fact, it seems like they encouraged it to places like the United States of America. That's fairly overt, is it not? It's extremely overt. We have what they've done when it comes to technological theft. You know, this is something people have harped about for a long time. It's kind of in the weeds, kind of detail-wise, but what is that? Well, companies and inventors, they have copyright, they have ownership over ideas and technology. China doesn't care about that at all. They'll just simply grab your newest phone, your newest piece of military technology, whatever it may be. They'll take it over there, they'll reverse engineer it, and they'll just lay claim to it, and they'll thumb their nose at anybody who raises a stink about that. So it's not just that they're competing. This is a country that's forceful about competing, and they don't care about your morality or my morality or the rules. They don't care. And they understand, let's just acknowledge this, they understand that whenever we have a Democrat in office, they can take that ball that they've been slowly moving up the field, they can really accelerate things. Exactly how much information did they get from that spy balloon? Marco Rubio talked about it.
I think what's embedded here is a clear message. It's not a coincidence that this happens leading up to the State of the Union address, leading up to Blinken's visit to China. The Chinese knew that this was going to be spotted. They knew that we were going to have to react to it. They flew it over military installations and sensitive sites right across the middle. I mean, look at the flight path of this thing. It's a diagonal shot right through the middle of the continental United States. And the message embedded in this to the world is we can fly a balloon over airspace of the United States of America, and they won't be able to do anything about it to stop us. They calculated this carefully with a message embedded in it. And I think that's the part we can't forget here. It's not just the balloon. It's the message they're trying to send the world that we can do whatever we want and America can't stop us.
China's purposeful about it. And that brings us to an uncomfortable question. One that makes us squirm in our chair. Why was that balloon allowed to do what it did? They knew about the balloon when it was over Alaska. They didn't shoot down the balloon until it got to the Atlantic Ocean. They allowed, our government allowed a Chinese spy balloon to traverse the entire United States of America without shooting it down. Why? Exactly how many of our politicians are compromised by the communist Chinese? They're famous for buying, threatening loyalty from people around the world. I mean, did you hear Angus King during the Pete Hegseth confirmation hearing? Really concerned about Pete's focus on China.
Mr. Hoffman, if you could... I was very disturbed in your opening statement where you talked about the priorities that you have. We will work with our partners and allies to deter aggression in the Indo-Pacific from the communist Chinese. There's not a single mention in this statement about Ukraine or Russia. Is this code for we're going to abandon Ukraine?
Senator, the president, that's a presidential level policy decision. He's made it very clear that he would like to see a end to that conflict. We know who the aggressor is. We know who the good guy is. We'd like to see it as advantageous for the Ukrainians as possible, but that war needs to come.
You talk a lot about deterrence of China. I would submit that Xi Jinping is watching what we do very carefully. If we abandon Ukraine, that would be the strongest signal possible to Xi Jinping that he can take Taiwan without significant resistance from this country.
Very interesting how many of them run cover for China. So, we have a great special for you tonight. We're going to talk to Natalie Winters about this next. She has some fascinating insight into how China operates, and we will talk to her in just a moment.
And then there's this theory, widely debunked. This paper from two Chinese researchers that says it is plausible that the virus leaked accidentally from one of two labs near the Wuhan seafood market.
Coronavirus was man-made in a lab in Wuhan, China. And yet this week, Donald Trump is still pushing the debunked bunkum, despite his own intelligence community's findings that that is simply not true.
The Wuhan lab, we know that it's been debunked that this virus was man-made or modified or anything like that.
Those same agencies now have been tapped with investigating one of Trump world's most favorite conspiracy theories.
Tom Cotton, one of Donald Trump's staunchest allies in the Senate, suggested that the virus might have originated in a high-security biochemical lab in China. In the 1980s, I remember when the far left trafficked in rumors about HIV having been invented in CIA labs. The far right has now found its own virus conspiracy theory.
Yes, the far right. Joining me now, investigative reporter, co-host of The War Room, Natalie Winters. Natalie, okay, so the CIA admitting that COVID came from a Chinese lab. Okay, we got all that, but one thing I've found fascinating this entire time is why cover it up at all? What difference does it make to me, an American, if it came from a bowl of bat soup or it came from a lab in Wuhan? But very clearly, the system wanted me to believe it was the bowl of bat soup. Why?
Yeah, it's certainly an Achilles heel. And I think that how you answer that question, there's sort of an interesting, whether you want to call it a limited hangout or sort of a reframe in terms of the idea of who is responsible for covering up the true origins of COVID-19. Because right now, everyone in the mainstream media class is quick to say, well, it was the Chinese Communist Party. It was the World Health Organization. But in reality, their Western counterparts, Western elites, are equally to blame, if not, I would argue, almost more so, right? Western media outlets were as bad, if not worse, than Chinese state-run communist propaganda outlets in terms of covering up, like that montage that you just played. And I think, you know, the question is, right, sort of cui bono, right? Who benefits from running cover for the Chinese Communist Party? And you're talking about the corporations who've been in business with them for so long, politicians whose career rises have been inextricably linked to that of the Chinese Communist Party. They've been on the receiving ends of campaign cash and, you know, weird blackmail schemes. Look no further than Hunter Biden. But that's because I think the unfortunate truth, to go very, I guess, meta here, is that the entire world economic kind of system and order that we run on rests upon the Chinese Communist Party staying in power. And the original sin of that economic model is that the Chinese people are essentially slave laborers. And if you were to give the Chinese Communist Party, I think, a nice reflection in the mirror of what they did with COVID-19, what they've subjected their own people to, let alone the whole world, world, not only would you see, I think, internal discontent and strife, like you saw, I think, a little whimper of, at least before the Western press came in and quashed it, at least domestically in China, but these corporations, these people would be forced to answer for their decades of collaborationist sentiment and just straight up collaboration with the enemy that I think it's never been clearer than what they did with COVID-19.
Explain to me the media perspective as it pertains to China. It's not difficult to figure out why some filthy Chi-Com would want to cover up that it came from a lab. It's not difficult to figure out why a CEO who set up his factory in, you know, Shanghai would want to say it came from a bowl of bat soup. But the anchor at CNN, he's got five viewers. Why wouldn't he just come out and say what we really all kind of knew to begin with? What does it bother him?
Well, the chapter and verse answer to your question is that the Chinese Communist Party has been running sophisticated, very targeted media infiltration and warfare campaigns against Western journalists for a very, very long time. They have something called the United Front Work Department, which is a multi-billion dollar political warfare operation that emanates out of Beijing. It's closely run by the Chinese Communist Party, and it's sort of the apparatus, the element that they use to target not just Western journalists, but academics and think tankers and politicians, and of course their kin and their next of kin. And in the case of media, they obviously know that controlling public opinion is very, very important, especially at home, but also even more importantly abroad here in the United States. So they have a myriad of tactics that they use, but one of their preferred tactics is basically paying Western journalists to come overseas. So to go and visit China on subsidized trips. So the Chinese Communist Party or groups that are very innocuously named, like the China United States Exchange Foundation, will subsidize these trips. They tour not just military facilities, they tour Huawei. They basically get propaganda to the max from legitimate de facto elements of de jure elements of the Chinese Communist Party. But I had broke this story 2-3 years ago through the Foreign Agent Registration Act filings. And the most interesting part is that not only did they admit to seeking out journalists that they thought would provide them, quote, favorable coverage, but that upon return, they had to, quote, disseminate positive messages about the Chinese Communist Party and their sort of rise in this neoliberal world order. And this isn't just some niche journalists that they were picking. It was the Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, people like Matthew Iglesias, a lot of these, you know, bigwig lefty journalist types who were involved in this very explicit pay-for-play journalism type scheme that's actual foreign interference and foreign collusion, if you want to take the left, I guess, do some cultural appropriation. But that's sort of, I think, just one anecdote. But that's why you see the coverage that you do, because it's full-scale political warfare.
I'm so jealous. I mean, the Chi-Coms hate me, so I'm never going to be able to go over there. But I want to go to I want to see the Great Wall of China. And I can't ever go into that country or I'll be arrested. But that would be freaking sweet. Okay, so Trump, as it relates to China, did not exactly end on a positive note with that country. Everyone knows he's always talking about China. Where are they now?
Well, look, President Trump was very clairvoyant. He actually sanctioned, basically put into oblivion a lot of these United Front Work Department groups that were targeting local level officials, governors, state level officials. They were making a hardcore press when it came to agricultural officials across this country too. Look, I think when President Trump invited Xi Jinping for, I think, scholars and people who pay attention or to the inauguration, for people who pay attention to Chinese history, they are very obsessed with the concept of, right, the Thucydides trap, the idea that the Chinese Communist Party is sort of on the ascent and will replace the United States, not in a multipolar world order, but in a new unipolar world order where they become the new global hegemon. And they love the idea of sort of foreign countries having to be supplicants and coming and sort of, for lack of a better word, kowtowing to Chinese Communist Party leaders, to Chinese Communist Party run businesses. So I think it was sort of an epic troll when President Trump did invite Xi Jinping to the inauguration. And I think you've sort of seen that legacy continue. But much like I think that montage that you just played showing how they framed the origins of COVID as, you know, the racist and, you know, nativist elements of the far right, like myself and yourself included, were wrong on COVID. I think this whole framing now of the tariffs, the trade war, and all that is something that's sort of akin to that, What do I mean by that? The trade war has been waged against the United States by the Chinese Communist Party since their ascension into the World Trade Organization, right? They have been crippling our economy, our various industries with intellectual property theft, you name it, a myriad of economic warfare tactics that's codified into their military doctrine. We're finally now just punching back. And I think you can tell that the tariffs are something that really, really freaked them out because they've been sort of melting down about them. I hope President Trump, you know, sticks to his guns and actually institutes them. But I think that people should really pay attention to the way that the mainstream media covers it, because anybody who uses the term trade war and thinks that Donald Trump is the aggressor when it comes to China is so woefully mistaken, not just on the lived economic reality of Americans, but just basic financial and economic metrics that you can see how the Chinese Communist Party has been abusing this country and our economy for so long.
Natalie, the H-1B visas got into the news recently, and of course we were told that we must have all these people here because us stupid Americans have the gall to play sports and talk to girls. But of course it's just a system that is used to abuse the American worker. The Chinese have been doing this, haven't they?
Of course, I think you left out that we're too busy having sleepovers as well. No sleepovers with the Kelly
Council.
The H-1B issue is so interesting. I think if you put it through the lens, you know, it's so easy for us to like think of big pharma lobbyists, right, or big tobacco, or whatever, the way that they lie to us only to boost profits of a certain industry, right? That's sort of the MO of the whole lobbying apparatus. The H-1B debacle is quite literally no different than Pfizer lobbyists or Moderna lobbyists wanting to get vaccine mandates implemented so they can have better profit margins. What do I mean by that? The data to create the narrative that Americans need to import people who come from what? Backwards third world countries where they're woefully underperforming and less skilled than the average American worker, that the reason why we need to import them is because A, there's the best and the brightest. I'm sure everyone's heard that lovely alliterative phrase. And that we have a shortage of workers here, so we need to therefore bring in the best and the brightest. Those two sort of compounding factors that create this lie that then necessitates the mass importation of H-1B visa holders is rooted in completely BS and bogus science. Even the Government Accountability Office, when they actually went into the National Science Foundation, the original report that was sort of the footnote for any time anyone would ever make these claims, they even admitted that the data was never there. It looks like they more or less made it up. The overwhelming majority of H-1B visa holders that they're importing, I'm talking like upwards of 80%, make less than the average salary of a tech worker, because over 80% of them are actually in the bottom 1% in terms of skills. They're not the, you know, best and brightest category of the top of the H-1B stuff, which anyways would be the O-1B visa category, which is its kind of own category to begin with. So the H-1B stuff, like I'm sure people have seen the screenshots online, they're not glamorous jobs. They're not people who are necessarily making this country better. They like to, you know, tout statistics saying that every H-1B that you bring in creates X or amount of jobs for American citizens. It's not true. And on the opposite side of the coin, when you look at the numbers of Americans, not just who are unemployed, but particularly Americans with STEM degrees who will never work in STEM, you're talking about one in two American STEM graduates who, despite graduating from an accredited United States-based institution and actually can speak English, unlike half of these H-1B people, will never work in STEM because their job is going to be outsourced to someone from likely India or China. And by the way, Jesse, just to, I think, really make this whole debate even more just absurd, the same people who are telling us that we need to what? Import the quote best and brightest so we can be competitive with the Chinese Communist Party are advocating for a visa program where the second largest beneficiary and recipient of importing people from a certain country under this visa category, the H-1B, is none other than China. A country that, what, per Article 7 of their national intelligence law, stipulates that any Chinese citizen can be weaponized against the United States at any moment, for any purpose, and at any time. Gee, I wonder why the United States is getting hacked so much and why intellectual property theft is off the charts. Because we're quite literally importing the enemy into our country just so we can suppress wages of Americans and make these evil America-hating corporations better profit margins.
Seems bad. That's why I never graduated in STEM, other than I had to drop math. I just knew there was no point in it, so I just dropped out. Natalie, thank you. Appreciate you, as always. We're not done yet. We'll be back.
If we stay on the road we're on right now, in less than 10 years, virtually everything that matters to us in life will depend on whether China will allow us to have it or not. Everything from the blood pressure medicine we take to what movies we get to watch and everything in between, we will depend on China for it. They have come to dominate the critical mineral industry supplies throughout the world. Everywhere in the world, they've now established critical mineral rights. Even those who want to see more electric cars, no matter where you make them, those batteries are almost entirely dependent on the ability of the Chinese and the willingness of the Chinese Communist Party to produce it and export it to you. So if we don't change course, we are going to live in a world where much of what matters to us on a daily basis, from our security to our health, will be dependent on whether the Chinese allow us to have it or not. That's an unacceptable outcome.
That is, of all the confirmation nonsense we've seen, that may be the most eye-popping and ominous little 15, 30-second cut that I've seen so far. Joining me now is someone who knows quite a bit about China, economies, everything else. Economist Peter St. Ange, by the way. Go to profstange.com if you want to consume his stuff, which I most definitely do. That's why I lean on him. Okay, Peter, first of all, what does that mean? How did we end up on the, if Marco Rubio is correct, and I'm assuming he is, and we're on a course to have everything run through China, let's start at the beginning. How did we get on such a course? When did this happen?
Yeah, well, there was a time when America was the dominant manufacturer in the world. Europe would sit around and complain about how, you know, there will come a day when we will make nothing in Europe anymore. Everything will be made in America. And we threw it away. The way that I sum it is that we shot ourselves in the foot and we put ourselves in a position where now we have to rent a wheelchair from China and we're pissed off about it. So the solution to that, of course, is stop shooting yourself in the foot. So that means reduce regulations, the green mandates, the DEI, the social policy. A lot of the regulation is just corrupt. Industries just buy it. Basically, large operators buy it to try to shut out the little guy, the end result burdens on small companies. And the big companies, they get the burdens too. They got to face all those regulations, but they just move the production over to China. So you go from a world where things are made in America to a world where things might even still be made by American companies, but they're making it all in China.
Peter, why take anything to China when they have so much control of the market? You know, so if I'm making a Apple products or something like that. This is a pretty good example. And I decide I would rather move my factory to China because of all the laws and regulations here in America. Well, why would I move it to a communist country where they control everything? What do I get from that?
Yeah, well, that's what's changing a lot now. So the sort of dirty secret here, the way that China got a lot of companies to move there instead of some other poor country like Mexico, is that they used access to their market as the carrot. So if you, BMW, wanted to sell your cars in China, you had to produce your cars in China. Now, ironically, that's exactly what Donald Trump is proposing to do in America. And guess what? It works if you have a large market. It doesn't work if you're a small country. If you're like Honduras and you try to produce your own steel, good luck. That's not going to work. But if you're a large country, and the U.S. is about a quarter of the entire world economy, all right, so we are even bigger than China. If you're a big market, yes, that works. You can lean on companies. You can tell, say, Toyota, if you guys want to sell cars in America, you don't want tariffs on it, you don't want, you know, harassment and on the customs, then you have to produce it here. That absolutely worked for China, worked in Korea, worked in Japan. Donald Trump wants to do it here.
Okay, Peter, talk to me about this Chinese economy. As you pointed out, we're still larger than them. That gap is closing from what I understand, but how is their economy? Because I swear on my life, you open up the newspaper one day and you'll find out that this is some Chinese juggernaut that's going to overtake us in 15 minutes. And the next day you find out it's hanging by a thread and they're about to have some huge depression. What is it?
Yeah, so I think that the fundamentals in China are better than ours in many ways. When I was a kid, people used to dismiss Japan. They said, Asians don't invent anything. They just copy stuff. BS. All right, if you look at patents, you look at, you know, the creative arts, places like Japan and Korea are knocking our socks off. it's not that there's some fundamental flaw in Asia. And China especially has been very, very smart about the educational system. It focuses on, you know, math, reading, logic. A lot of it is industrial skills. So you have, you know, vo-tech schools where kids actually start working in factories and then they work their way up towards, you know, design and towards higher and higher and work. So China is, I think, on the fundamentals, they're very, very much on the ball. They're very rational about regulation. They understand the difficulties of manufacturing, and the government tends to partner with companies and try to fix problems instead of sort of hunting them down. Having said, China's problem at the moment is that the current leadership is very, very suspicious of markets. So President Xi sort of idolizes Mao Zedong. He thinks that it was a mistake to open up the economy so much that it has allowed private businesses to start muscling in and taking power from the Communist Party. So Xi himself, he has almost halved the growth rate in China. He's actually done worse recently. China's flirting with actual recession. And so during most of my lifetime, China had been catching up. Since President Xi came in, it's actually flattened out, or in some ways the US is actually growing ahead of China. So if, you know, Xi's relatively young, he's probably gonna be in power for another 10, 15 years, given how it works in China. He has wiped out any sort of rivals. So the next 10 or 15 years in China may actually be slow to declining. They may start to look at sort of a Japanese-style lost decade.
Economically, what's the Russia-Chinese relationship? Because traditionally, the way of thinking is Russia has the resources, doesn't have the people. China has the people, not the resources, so they come to some sort of an agreement. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That sort of captures it traditionally. Russia is aware that it would take very, very few Chinese to essentially steal the entire eastern two-thirds of the country. You know, Russia's population is about 140 million. Almost all of those people live in the Western European part of the country. There's almost nobody in the entire eastern part. So Russia's always been very, very suspicious of Chinese immigration, of Chinese influence in the East. What I think is sort of a sad tragedy of what happened with the Ukraine war is that the sanctions, the sort of Western aggressiveness towards Russia has pushed it into the point where it is now an economic colony of China. It's completely reliant on China. The Chinese, of course, are they're no dummies. They're taking advantage of the Russians as much as possible to try to grab resources and to grab control over Russia. And even after that war ends, I think that the Chinese are going to keep that control. And, you know, where we go from here is that China is doing everything it can to turn Russia into an economic colony. They themselves have to be a little bit careful. They don't want to cross the sanctions line and get sanctions thrown towards them. That was their concern under Biden. Trump, of course, is much more aggressive and much more willing to do that. So I think China is trying to be careful. But fundamentally, I think that the longest sort of effect of the Ukraine war is going to be turning Russia into a colony of China.
Tell me about BRICS, Peter. It's a conversation you and I have had before. This alternate currency, the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and then Brazil, Russia, India, China, so on and so forth, have gotten together and decided they're going to kind of try to come up with an alternative to that. Does Trump getting elected kneecap that effort, ramp up that effort? Where is all that?
Yeah, I think both of us have been watching BRICS for a while, and it's interesting because that's probably the most serious threat to the U.S. dollar in terms of another currency. Now, the real threat to the U.S. dollar, of course, is gold or some other commodity money as the dollar falls apart. But BRICS was really the most serious currency competitor. And to be honest, I think that BRICS has taken the wind out of its own sails. They came out this year and pivoted from as a sort of gold-backed, stronger competitor to dollar, to instead looking at this sort of goofy basket of currencies where you throw in all of these, frankly, pretty lousy currencies. You know, Brazil's got a hyperinflationary past, Russia as well. The Chinese currency is completely controlled by the government. So at this point, I think in the near term, BRICS is actually probably not a threat at all. Russia is obviously very distracted with its war. China's distracted with its own economic problems at this point, as well as it's going to have to dance for Trump, or it's going to get into trouble. So I don't think anything's going to come out of BRICS at this point. In terms of what's next for the dollar, I think there's actually a lot of sort of moving parts there. So on the one hand, Trump had threatened that any country that goes too deep into the BRICS alliance, he's going to, I think he threatened 50, 100% sanctions, which is basically existential. That's close to economic war. But on the other hand, Trump and J.D. Vance have both talked about wanting a weaker dollar. The reason they want that is to make U.S. exports cheaper. I'm not a huge fan of that because it also bankrupts the American people. So I would rather that we, you know, fix the taxes, fix the regulations, perhaps use strategic tariffs where you have bad faith partners like China, rather than sort of selling off the family jewels just to increase exports. But Trump's got kind of a complex relationship here where he's been very, very hyper aggressive against BRICS as a threat to the U.S. dollar. But at the same time, he's also welcomed the idea of a weaker dollar.
Yeah. Peter, as always, outstanding. Thank you, my friend. All right. Still not done with China quite yet. Hang on.
The way our system works, the way our bureaucratic system works, where the speed of weapons procurement works, we're always a decade behind in fighting the last war. Whereas China, we have, you know, what did Rumsfeld say? You go to the war, the army you have. China's building an army specifically dedicated to defeating the United States of America. That is their strategic outset. Take hypersonic missiles. So if our whole power projection platform is aircraft carriers and the ability to project power that way strategically around the globe. And yeah, we have a nuclear triad and all of that, but a big part of it. And if, you know, 15 hypersonic missiles can take out our 10 aircraft carriers in the first 20 minutes of a conflict, what does that look like?
Well, that's one of the most terrifying things I've ever heard. And I have heard that before from people who would know, figured Stephen Yates is about as good a person you can ask about these things as anyone around. Joining me now, national security expert with the Heritage Foundation, Stephen Yates. Okay, Stephen, I have heard this before, that we have a carrier-based Navy, carrier-based military, you could make the argument, and that China is attempting to, or has already succeeded, depending on who you're talking to, come up with something that will simply erase these things and sweep them off the chessboard. What's going on?
Well, now Secretary of Defense Hegseth was absolutely correct. We've had this back and forth in Congress and in the media for a very, very long time. There's several annual reports that commissions put out, that committees on the Hill put out, that have always noted that China's military capabilities were, as Pete Hegseth stated, aimed at defeating the United States, and that they were using comprehensive national power to do that. That their manufacturing supply chains were racing far ahead of our previous estimates in doing so. The United States, as Secretary Hegseth was noting, has been just tragically slow to come up with what's our concept of warfare in this new era. But then our manufacturing supply chains have been woefully slow, corrupted, I would argue, and inadequate to the cause.
Okay, that's a lot. Let's focus on us right now. Why are we so slow in coming up with this? Is this just a change in administrations? You know, not that I want to be a dirty communist in like China, but having that consistency does help maintaining one foreign policy vision. Is it that? Is it, what is it? Why have we been slow?
I would argue that there is a part of this that's strategic, and that's the part that changes in administration can sometimes help, where you have to get out of the mindset of winning the last war and get dialed into what are the current challenges facing us, and we have new tools. And so this administration has a unique opportunity with incredibly different people from tech and manufacturing and investment backgrounds that should, under the right circumstances with the right oomph, be able to revolutionize our supply chains and deploy tech-assisted new forms of warfare that should make things harder for China. So we get past that carrier-based approach that we've had basically since World War II and onward. So that's one piece. The manufacturing part, though, that's where the swamp thing has been the problem, where there's huge vested interests that constantly deliver things late and over budget. We have allies that have already paid, and they're waiting years after targets to receive deterrent that would help avoid Americans having to intervene. And then there's the disservice to ourselves, falling behind on the number of ships and planes and other things that we should have for our own national interests.
Stephen, people who pay attention to the budget and spending, when they hear people say what you just said, which is true, that we're falling behind on planes and ships and things like that, they look at the budget and they ask the question I'm about to ask you. How can that possibly be? How can we not have the most state-of-the-art ships in the world right now, given the ridiculous military budget we have? If it's not going to the ships, where is it going?
Well, I think it comes down to corruption, inefficiency, and bureaucracy, which may all be three ways of saying the same thing. But that ultimately, I think, has been the Achilles heel of the sole remaining superpower. It's why I think that we have a generational opportunity that we need to seize, because if we miss it, I think that the Republic is at risk in this DOGE effort. And it's got to focus on redoing these manufacturing supply chains, specifically in the Pentagon and the Beltway Bandits, who have fueled those supply chains for decades. That's where Elon Musk showed he was able to outmatch NASA's bureaucracy and putting important technology into space. We need to mirror that kind of effort inside government. They'll meet with resistance, but that's where the pit bull in chief needs to come in, and the richest man in the world and others need to weigh in to carve out this new opportunity.
Let's go back to China, because that's really what we're talking about here. Tell me about these missiles, these hypersonic missiles. Do we have countermeasures? What else is China doing that concerns you?
Well, in short, China's doing everything. And it's kind of a joke, but it's a very serious situation. They are investing in everything, human intelligence to cyber capabilities to space assets. They're investing in things that would defeat our core capabilities. They've gone very, very far ahead in bio warfare and chemical warfare. They don't really have the ethical restraints and accountability restraints that we have in our systems. And so they've been pushing ahead in everything. And they've also compromised our homeland security in any number of ways, from the border to all kinds of entities that are psychologically damaging to our youth. It's another discussion on social media apps, perhaps. But they have had a comprehensive approach, and they don't really see a pushback coming from the United States until perhaps now. This is where President Trump has the opportunity to reset this narrative of America on decline and China on the rise, and somehow that's inevitable. I think China's got some problems, and if Trump gets America back on the right footing in defense and otherwise, we have this golden age he's talked about that will have to recalibrate what China's calculus is.
What problems do they have right now, Stephen? It's easy when you look at the length and breadth of everything they're doing that it's easy to just think, oh my gosh, it is, you know, the rising sun, if you'll pardon the pun. But they do have major problems too. What are they?
They do. And one of the things that we can't kind of bank our lives on, but it's been a reality in every other conflict, is they have a very large military order of battle when it's on paper, but it is profoundly untested against peer or better enemy combatants. And when you look at what the Iraqi National Guard was going into the first Gulf War and later, and when you look at what Russia's prohibitive military capability was going into Ukraine, these big powers, I think, have to be somewhat humble about what reality is when they have to grind into actual combat. And so there's that reality that comes into play. And China's not known for quality control. They are known for manufacturing at speed and volume. And if things break, so be it, and their people are expendable, well, their people might not like that, and they might not be as sustainable in conflict as they think going into it. The people might not be on board with sacrificing so much if they aren't convinced that it was absolutely necessary.
These big powers like China and Russia, they stumble walking into things like Ukraine. What is it that makes them stumble? Is it the logistics? Do they not have the people they think? Does their equipment just suck? You can certainly see that being a problem for China. What is it that makes them stumble?
Well, I think one part of it is a reality that you know very well. It's a lot easier to hit back, to attack, to try to break something, to thwart something, than it is to invade, occupy, and hold a different territory. And that doesn't matter whether that is over air, sea, or land. It is just a fundamental reality. If you have people and material that's positioned in a way to resist, and there is a resiliency to that supply, it's tough. And so I think when you look at when Russia went into Ukraine, you had Granny with a gun willing to use it. That made some difference. But you also just had this reality. They could take some of that territory in their near abroad, but they met with a resistance that has sustained for years. Now, Ukraine still paid a dear price. If China moved against Taiwan, that would be a price that no one really wants to have to pay. But China is untested in trying to see how much they would really be willing to pay if they met with resistance. And if Japan, Taiwan, the United States, and others were serious about capabilities that degraded China in its own territory, I think alters the calculus. I think we have frankly been fighting with hands tied behind our backs with theories of the past, and that has enabled China to get, I think, a little bit too much hubris.
Finally, Stephen, let's talk about Japan really quickly. Ever since World War II, obviously there have been limits on what they're allowed to do, but what are they? I know they're not China. What are they? What are their capabilities? I know they're a valuable ally in all this.
Well, they are very good at manufacturing. They are very, I think, good at quality control in contrast to China. They have had, as you allude, some constraints that have been placed upon them, some that they've put on themselves to be committed to just pure self-defense. But former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, the late Prime Minister, he began to change their way of thinking about defense and recognizing that they needed to have sort of active self-defense, which was a euphemism for we're going to be able to be a more normal country and punch beyond our territorial waters and airspace when needed. And I think it's a good thing for the United States and the world to have a responsible stakeholder like Japan, which they may be a lethargic economy, but they're still very big and they're a significant country and they have significant capabilities. They also have historic ties to places like Taiwan that are underappreciated. And that's why I think China has to be very careful. It's not just the United States that might have a national interest in engaging. Japan and others may too. And so that's what makes this less of a cakewalk. We can't bank on that. No one should take it easy or lightly. But I think China, if they're sober about this, should be more cautious than they've been.
Here's hoping. Stephen, thank you so much. I appreciate you. All right. We'll be back. It is important to acknowledge that China is rapidly approaching status as being a near peer. Economically, militarily, they are gaining on us. And unlike other countries that have done that in the past, or at least flirted with that, they are dead set on overtaking us. They write it down. They acknowledge it. And so what does that mean for us? It doesn't mean we have to panic, run around screaming the sky is falling, hiding under our desks, but it does mean we have to be equally as purposeful looking back at them trying to win, because we clearly are in a competition. They have made that decision and we must win, because losing means very, very ugly things. So we keep marching forward, all right? Do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast.